previous head counselor, was all those things and more. Sherman Yang? Him? I wasn't so sure about. Sherman took over when Clarice left Camp Half-Blood to go to college. He was a typical Ares kid, meaning a ferocious, muscle-bound fighting machine with a yen for bloody conflict and a disdain for peace. But as impressive as those qualities were, I wondered if they were enough to lead our cabin. More importantly, were they enough to lead us to victory over the other cabins? If not, well, let's just say I was secretly studying him to find his Achilles heel. Not long after Sherman took over, Ares' cabin scored poorly on the daily camp inspection. One of my sisters had left a plate of sticky, sweet barbecue under her bunk, and ants had swarmed it. Not the gigantic Myrmikis. They prefer shiny things to smoked meats. It would have been okay if the Myrmikis had invaded, actually. Things had been so calm lately, I wouldn't have minded going a few rounds with them, sword versus mandible. Anyway, our chore that day was combat arena and archery range prep. I loved practicing in the fighting zones, but tidying up afterward and getting everything ready for the next session, I'd rather tackle the Nemean lion. And from the looks on my cabin mates' faces, they felt the same way. We might have staged a sit-down if non-aggressive protest didn't sicken us so much. Instead, we trudged out to the arenas. To my surprise, a number of campers from other cabins were there too. So was Sherman, which kind of surprised me, because he normally wasn't the first one on site when we had to do chores.
"Ares' cabin," he barked. "Take a knee."
I didn't get what was going on. We were supposed to be doing prep. And why were all these other campers here? Nevertheless, we Ares kids knelt as one and waited to see what would happen.
"I'm running a friendly little relay race today," Sherman announced to the whole crowd. "Who wants in?"
The Ares kids all started raising our hands naturally. I still didn't understand why Sherman was holding a race instead of making us do our assigned tasks, but I wasn't going to argue. He gestured at us impatiently.
"No, no, not you, Ares Cabin. You're just here as observers. This race is in the arena and archery range, and you know those areas too well. It wouldn't be fair to the other competitors."
Fair? How could this guy be the head of our cabin? I almost stormed away in disgust, but then I noticed the crafty twinkle in Sherman's eye. He was up to something. What? I didn't know, but I wanted to find out.
"What do we win?" asked Cecil Markowitz.
That kid, always thinking about the potential payout. Sherman smiled slyly.
"Whoever finishes first gets to fire the t-shirt gun tonight."
His announcement caused a ripple of excitement. Guns weren't a big favorite at Camp Half-Blood. Most campers preferred the traditional weapons of ancient Greece. The Ares Cabin t-shirt gun was one of the few exceptions. It shot tightly rolled Half-Blood tees 50 feet in the air. It was a real crowd pleaser during camp sing-alongs and volleyball matches. After some jostling and debate, five contestants stood up to volunteer. Will Solis, Miranda Gardiner, Billy Ng, Cecil Markowitz, and Damian White. My money was on Will or Damian to win whatever Sherman had cooked up. Will, because he was clever and quick. Damian, because he was devious.
"Competitors!"
Sherman held up a hand, fingers splayed.
"This race consists of five tasks, which are as follows. Each of you must sharpen the blades of two practice swords. Then you must replace four used archery targets with new ones. After that, you polish a shield. Then you must replace the points on three spears. Finally, reattach a straw dummy's limbs and head. Then return here to me."
Sherman curled his fingers into a fist. "Any questions?" I was biting the inside of my cheek to keep the smirk off my face. I had to give it to Sherman. He'd come up with a great plan to get the other campers to do our work. Nothing like the promise of firing a large gun to keep people from thinking straight. Sherman lined up the racers and bellowed, "Go!" Off they raced. 20 minutes later, Miranda crossed the finish line first. Gasping, she raised a triumphant fist in the air. Sherman grabbed her in a hug, then quickly let go, red-faced and grinning sheepishly. We Aries kids cheered lustily for the victor, for the chores we didn't have to do, and most of all, for Sherman, our ace head counselor.
The Volleyball Court, brought to you by Pete the Palicus. Whether you're a serious player or just a camper looking for a little fun competition, there's no better place than the volleyball court to feel the sun on your back, the wind in your hair, or a ball in your face. Come to play, come to watch, come to catch a t-shirt from the Aries Cabin's gun. Just come.
Game Changer by Laurel and Holly Victor. Laurel: Check it. We're in charge of the volleyball court. Holly: We keep it ready to go. Laurel: Makes me sick. Holly: The court? Laurel: No, that campers play for fun, as in... Holly: Don't say it. Laurel: Recreationally. Holly: Gross. Pointless. Laurel: Totally goes against our heritage. Holly: True that. Ancient Greeks loved organized competitive sports. Laurel: Hello, ever hear of the Olympics? Holly: Or the Panathenaea? Laurel: Sand courts were everywhere back then. Ancient Greeks wrestled and boxed in them. Holly: Call them palestri, singular, palestra. Laurel: After Palestra, the goddess who invented wrestling. Holly: Hear that, boys? The goddess of wrestling. Laurel: Girl power! Holly: They wrestled naked. Laurel: So, no place to hide weapons. Holly: Palestra ruled the ring. Laurel: Like we rule the court. Holly: Victors 20, opponents 0. Can I get an, oh yeah? Laurel: Oh yeah. Know who I'd like to take on? Holly: I know who I'd like to take on. Laurel and Holly: The Hunters. Holly: Check it, newbies. When the Hunters are at camp, we play capture the flag. Laurel: Hunters 56, half-blood 0, unacceptable result. Holly: So I'm hiding the flags the next time they show. Laurel: Can't play capture the flag without flags to capture. Holly: Then we'll throw down a volleyball challenge. Laurel: Victors versus Hunters. Two of them against the two of us. Holly: Those Hunters, they'll look like frightened prey. Laurel: Deer looking down the wrong end of an arrow. Holly: Mixed green salad looking down the wrong end of a fork. Laurel: What? Holly: I'm going vegetarian. Laurel: Hey, me too. Holly: Since when? Laurel: Since before you decided to. Holly: I decided it first. Laurel: Did not. Holly: Did too. Laurel: This conversation is over. Holly: It's over when I say it's over. Laurel and Holly: It's over. Tinkering. The Forge
Brought to you by Pete the Pelicus. So you're taking a walk in the wild, minding your own business, when, wham, a chunk of celestial bronze falls from the sky and almost kills you. What do you do now? I'll tell you what. You bring that bronze on down to the hottest place in camp, the forge. Cabin 9 campers will jump at the chance to hammer the mystical metal into a weapon, a shield, armor, or even, wink wink, a helmet. While there, you might catch a glimpse of everyone's favorite Cyclops Tyson, and maybe you can get the Hephaestus kids to ask their dad to watch where he tosses his scraps next time. The Arts and Crafts Center, brought to you by Pete the Pelicus. Creative juices flow freely in this airy studio. It's a favorite place of Athena's children, who come to sculpt, paint, weave, and do ceramics. But anyone is welcome to embrace their artistic side here. Also, their artistic front and top, but please refrain from embracing bottoms. Skeins of naturally dyed yarn, easels with stretched canvases, blocks of marble and clay, and all the tools and paints you could ask for await. Bunker 9, brought to you by Pete the Pelicus. This cavernous workshop lies underground, nestled deep in the woods at the foot of the western hills. Bunker 9 was sealed following the first demigod civil war and eventually lost to memory. For more than 150 years, it sat like a time capsule waiting to be discovered. But now, thanks to the fiery touch of Leo Valdez, its secrets and mechanical supplies are within reach. Are you curious enough to venture in? Number 130 in Bunker 9 by Nissa Barrera. Bunker 9 is an amazing place, but if you're ever there, steer clear of the shadowy corner way in back. Something bad sits there. If you do decide to look, take my advice, don't touch it. Think I'm kidding? Read on. Late one afternoon, Connor Stoll, Sherman Yang, Valentina Diaz, Paolo Montez, Butch Walker, and I were hanging out on the beach when talk turned to camp curses. Remember the rhyming couplet curse Apollo Cabin threw that time? Butch asked. I'm coming in your direction, so get ready for cabin inspection. Valentina giggled. My cabin did one years ago called the Sweetie Curse. Anyone with a secret crush was compelled to call the object of their affection Sweetie. She glanced at Paolo from under her lashes. I wonder what would happen if I hurled that curse now. Paolo beamed uncomprehendingly. Sherman nudged my shoulder. What about you, Nissa? Got any good curse stories? I shifted uncomfortably. Just one. Well, let's hear it. I can't. It's more something I would have to show. I wanted to drop the subject, but they wouldn't let it go. They just kept cajoling me until finally I said, all right, fine, wait here. I ran back to my cabin and retrieved an old book from my storage locker. The book's coal black leather cover had orange lettering stamped into it, and a small keyhole padlock kept it closed. Reluctantly, I brought it back to the beach. Valentina squealed when she saw it. That's a vintage diary, isn't it? She asked. They sold them in the camp store back in the 50s. This one is from the 40s, I corrected. It belonged to Heloise, one of my siblings. I found it stashed behind a false panel under my bunk. Valentina rubbed her hands eagerly. OMG, I love reading other people's diaries. Not that I would ever do that without permission, of course, she added hurriedly. So what does Heloise's diary have to do with curses?
Sherman asked.
Everything, I said grimly. Listen.
June 10th, 1948. Diary. Back at camp. This summer's project? A race car that runs on Greek fire.
June 13th, 1948. Diary. Sketches complete. Materials gathered. Construction starts tomorrow.
June 16th, 1948. Diary. Outraged. Caught a son of Aphrodite poking around my stuff. Claims he's a car fanatic and came to check out my wheels. Lies, most likely.
June 17th, 1948. Diary. The boy came back. He asked questions about my car. Smart questions. Might have misjudged him.
June 19th, 1948. Dear Diary. James has blonde hair and sky blue eyes. Girls are in love with him. The naiads, too. They dragged him into the lake today and almost drowned him. Ridiculous.
June 20th, 1948. Dear Diary. James brought me a jar of Greek fire at lunch today. All the other girls stared at me.
June 22nd, 1948. Dear Diary, the car is finished. I put in butter yellow leather seats and painted it sky blue.
June 26th, 1948.
Dear Diary, first test drive successful. James wanted to do it, but I wouldn't let him. If anything bad happened, I'd want it to happen to me.
June 28th, 1948.
Dearest Diary, James says he wants to be an actor someday, but if that doesn't work out, maybe he'll be a race car driver, but only if I design his car. I think he was joking.
June 30th, 1948.
Dearest Diary, the second test drive was even better. I let James put in the Greek fire. A little must have leaked out because when our hands touched, my fingers burned.
July 2nd, 1948.
Dearest Diary, James drove the car around the chariot track today. The other girls watched him. He hugged me after and said the car's engine purrs like a kitten.
July 2nd, 1948. Midnight.
Dearest Diary, I'm purring too.
July 3rd, 1948.
Dearest Diary, tomorrow night there will be fireworks on the beach. I'll help set them up. Then I'll look for James.
July 4th, 1948.
Diary, I found him with an Aries girl.
July 5th, 1948.
Diary, the car exploded in the middle of the night. I told Chiron it was the Greek fire. I told James I'm not building another one.
July 8th, 1948.
Diary, James visits the armory a lot these days.
July 10th, 1948.
Diary, I have a new project. Harmonia's necklace. The diary ended there. I took a deep breath and looked at my friends. They were staring at me with rapt attention.
Harmonia was the daughter of Ares and Aphrodite, I told them. As you probably know, Aphrodite was my dad's wife. When Hephaestus found out about Harmonia, well, he wasn't too happy with Aphrodite. He fashioned a cursed item.
Valentina put her hand to her mouth. He cursed my mom?
Not her, Harmonia.
He made a beautiful cursed necklace and gave it to her on her wedding day. The rest of her life was basically misery. same for anyone who wore the necklace after her.
Butch frowned. So what does Harmonia's story have to do with Heloise and James?
Valentina rolled her eyes.
You're so thick. Heloise, daughter of Hephaestus, was in love with James, son of Aphrodite. Then she caught him with a daughter of Ares. The love triangle repeated. I nodded. And then Heloise started working on a project called Harmonia's Necklace.
A curse for the boyfriend who jilted her, Sherman said.
Yeah.
I showed them a black and white photograph of a cute teenage boy in an old-fashioned Camp Half-Blood t-shirt, sitting next to a girl who looked like a younger version of Rosie the Riveter. James and Heloise in 1948, and this is James in 1955.
I pulled out a close-up of a 20-something man with chiseled features and a sultry expression. Anyone recognize him?
Valentina's jaw dropped.
It's James Dean.
The sausage tycoon? Butch asked.
Not Jimmy Dean, you idiot. James Dean, the actor.
Valentina smoothed her hand over the photo.
He was a total hottie.
Hottie, Paolo confirmed in a heavy Brazilian accent.
Rebel, Eden, dead young.
Right, I said. James Dean rocketed to superstardom in 1955 with two movies, East of Eden and Rebel Without a Cause.
What did Paolo mean by dead young? Connor asked.
I showed them a third photo of James. He was sitting in a sleek silver race car with the number 130 painted on the hood and sides.
This was taken around September 22, 1955. Nice car, huh? It's a Porsche 550 Spider.
I laid down one last photo. And this was taken on September 30th. They all gasped. The Spider was a mangled wreck of twisted metal, identifiable only by the number 130.
James and a friend were driving to Salinas, California for a race, I told them. They stopped at a roadside store. The accident happened about half an hour later. James was killed in the crash. I chewed my lip. I think Heloise cursed the car when it was at the rest stop. She installed something, enchanted the chassis. I don't know exactly, but that was her secret project, codenamed Harmonia's Necklace.
Sherman frowned.
Car accidents happen all the time, Nyssa.
Yeah, but listen to this. The guy who hit them claims he never saw the car coming. After the crash, parts salvaged from the Spider were installed in other cars, and those cars were in horrible accidents. The wreck itself toppled from a truck bed and crushed a man's leg. A pair of thieves suffered freak injuries while trying to steal the steering wheel and seat covers. A garage housing the Spider's remains caught fire, but the car itself was untouched. Need I go on?
Where's the car now? Sherman asked.
It vanished in 1959. No mortal knows where it is.
Hang on, Butch said. No mortal?
I gazed toward the western hills.
It's in Bunker 9. I think my dad hid it there, or maybe Heloise did, to prevent the curse from hurting any more people.
I looked at them. Or to keep it as a trophy of her success. So that's the story. Maybe the curse on number 130 has faded. You want to touch that wreck in the shadows and find out? Be my guest. Me? I'm steering clear.
Wild Places.
Scene. The set of a game show. Three campers sit behind a table with dinger bells in front of them. Apollo stands behind a podium. He's dressed as a cheesy game show host. Open shirt, bright gold lamé jacket, skinny black pants.
Apollo. Welcome to our first annual Camp Half-Blood quiz show.
please give a warm welcome to our contestants. From Athena Cabin, Be Wise.
Applause.
From Ares Cabin, Arnold Beefcake.
Applause.
And representing our cloven-hoofed friends, Ferdinand Underwood the Satyr.
Hoof stomps.
Contestants, you know the rules. I ask a question. If you know the answer, ding your bell. Are you ready?
Wise, tapping temple. I think, therefore I am.
Beefcake, flexing.
Do your worst.
Underwood.
I ate my bell.
Apollo.
Excellent. Then let's begin. First question. Name the serpent I slayed.
Ding, ding.
Apollo.
Wise?
Wise. That's not a question.
Apollo.
Sorry. That's not a question is incorrect.
Wise. No, wait, I meant... Ding, ding. Beefcake.
The serpent was Python.
Apollo.
Correct.
Beefcake, showing two thumbs up.
Hey!
Apollo.
Next question.
Underwood.
So, should I just say ding, ding if I know the answer, or...
Apollo.
Who falsely accused me of flaying him alive after a music contest?
Underwood.
Blah, blah.
Apollo.
I'm sorry, blah, blah is incorrect. Also, you didn't ring in. The correct answer is Marcius the Satyr.
Wise.
Hang on, I knew that. You didn't give me a chance to answer.
Apollo.
He thought he was so great on those stupid twin pipes, but I showed him.
Beefcake.
Yeah, you did.
Wise.
I thought you were falsely accused.
Underwood.
Blah, blah.
Apollo.
Final question. Do you know what time it is?
Ding, ding.
Wise. Checks sun's location.
2:20.
Apollo.
It's dancing time.
Rips off jacket and shirt and starts hula hooping.
Hit it, boys!
Satyrs enter flailing ribbon sticks and tootling on reed pipes and cavort about the sun god.
Beefcake.
Oh, yeah!
Rips off shirt, twirls it in the air.
Now it's a party!
Wise, rubbing temples.
I can't believe I studied for this.
Ferdinand.
Ding, ding?
Ah, my retinas.
PJ.
Grove of the Council of Cloven Elders, brought to you by Pete the Palicus. Scouting around for a place of natural beauty for your next meeting? Consider reserving this idyllic, out-of-the-way clearing. Majestic old-growth trees surround a blanket of soft grass. Leaves rustle in the gentle breezes wafting in from the nearby shore. It's a short hike north of the Pegasus Stables, but worth every step. Iris message ahead, and the forest dryads will arrange for snacks and drinks. Note, special permission needed to use the rosebush topiary thrones.
Live and learn, so you can keep living, by Woodrow the Satyr.
I was honored when Percy Jackson asked me to tell you about the survival skills class I teach. Honored but puzzled, because I teach reed pipe music composition and appreciation, not Survival 101. So I sent paper airplane letters to two satyrs who taught the class before,
Grover Underwood, and Gleason Hedge to ask for their advice. Here are their replies. Sent on a slightly chewed brown paper bag.
Dear Woodrow, California is dry. Thanks for asking. I used the KISS approach. Keep it simple, Sater. When I taught the class, because so many students were ADHD. Here, in a nutshell, is my lesson plan. If you don't have a nutcracker, you can probably borrow one from the Dining Pavilion Dryads. Step 1. Scan your surroundings for immediate threats. Examples: fast-approaching monsters with claws deployed and fangs dripping venom. Cavernous pits rimmed with rotten banana peels. Clowns, both happy and sad-faced. Step 2. Take inventory. Helpful items to look for. Water, food, fire, more food. Step 3. Stay put and wait for rescue. Note, this last step only works if others are looking for you. Hope this helps. Wildly yours, Grover. Written on the back of a crayon drawing of a daddy satyr, a mommy wind nymph, and a tiny baby kid. Woodrow. Surviving is all about beating the odds. Also the evens. Those evens can be sneaky, so don't take your eyes off them. As for the beating, you can't go wrong with a sturdy length of wood. Ash is best, strong, lightweight, makes an excellent crack sound when it connects with its target. Stay away from pine. Smells nice, but too sticky. And you never know who might be living inside it. If you don't have a club handy, try a hoof kick to the solar plexus, a horn stab to the throat, and a rump butt to the gut. Booyah! Coach. I appreciated this sage advice, but decided to seek my own technique for survival training. So, I did what I often do when contemplating a challenge. I looked to the stars for guidance. That's when it hit me. I could teach demigods to look to the stars for guidance. Constellations are awesome orientation and navigation tools. They have great historic significance, too, since they're made up of beings and people placed in the heavens by the Greek gods. So, it was a win-win concept. Here's a little taste of my proposed lesson plan. Whatever Mother, or the WM-shaped constellation. Cassiopeia, queen of Ethiopia, bragged that she and her daughter Andromeda were more beautiful than Poseidon's girls, the Nereids. Gods, mother, embarrass me much? Groaned Andromeda. The Nereids complained to their dad. As punishment for Cassiopeia's boast, Poseidon sent Cetus, the sea monster, to wreak havoc on Ethiopia. The only way to end the reign of terror was to sacrifice Andromeda to the beast. Naturally, Cassiopeia didn't tell her daughter that. Instead, she lured Andromeda to the coast with promises of a lovely spa day by the sea. Once there, she chained her to a rock within easy snacking distance of Cetus. Mother! Andromeda was heard to complain over the pounding of the waves. These chains clash with my outfit. The salt spray is making my hair frizz. And when is my masseuse getting here? Here he comes now, Cassiopeia called back as Cetus reared out of the surf and charged the princess. Note, Grover would have identified Cetus as an immediate threat. Seconds before the monster struck, a figure swooped out of the sky. It was the hero Perseus. He drew his sword of diamonds. Ooh, shiny, Andromeda was heard to say over Cetus's snarls. Slew the beast, freed Andromeda, controlled her frizz with smoothing serum, and married her. They had 9 children, founded the city of Mycenae, and lived happily ever after. When they died, Perseus and Andromeda were turned into constellations. They're so dim, though, that they can be hard to find. Instead, look for Cassiopeia,
who was also set in the stars. As pushy in the heavens as she was on Earth, you can't miss her pattern. Five bright stars that form a W or M shape, depending on how you look at it. Find it, and you're on the right track to getting home. FYI, mother and daughter constellations are very close to each other. So close, in fact, that if you listen in on a moonless night, you can hear Andromeda telling Cassiopeia to back off and give her some space already. Bear with me. Zeus was sneaking around behind Hera's back, again, with a lovely female named Callisto, who happened to be one of Artemis's hunters. Why Callisto broke her vow to stay away from men is anyone's guess. Some say Zeus tricked her by disguising himself as Artemis. Hera found out about Zeus's infidelity, again, and with one angry poof, turned Callisto into a bear, which she then asked Artemis to hunt. Or maybe she asked Arcas, who was Zeus and Callisto's son and a skilled archer. The details are a little murky. Either way, Callisto the bear was staring down the pointy end of a drawn arrow when Zeus finally took notice.
This may be partially my fault,
Zeus confessed as he diffused the threat. Callisto reared up on her hind legs, crossed her paws over her hairy chest, and gave him the bear version of, "You think?"
Let me make it up to you.
He transformed her into stars and lobbed them into the sky. He did the same for Arcas, figuring the boy would be safe from Hera that way. The stars formed patterns that looked like bears, which is why the Greeks named them the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper. Ha ha, just kidding. The Greeks called them Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, or the Great Bear and the Little Bear. Ursa Major looks like a, well, like a big water dipper, actually, with a bent handle and a wide-mouthed bowl. Ursa Minor is a smaller version of a dipper with a handle that bends up instead of down. FYI, rumor has it that Zeus and Callisto secretly hang out when he's in his Roman form. He hides in the planet Jupiter, or maybe he becomes the planet Jupiter, and she revolves around him in the nearby moon named after her. Watch for a supernova in that quadrant of the sky when Hera discovers their trysts. Look to the stars for guidance. So, how do these stories help if you're lost? If you can pick out Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, and Cassiopeia in the night sky, you can find north. The three constellations are bunched up around Polaris, the one fixed star in the sky. Find the constellations, and you can find Polaris. Find Polaris, and you've found north. Find north, and you can figure out where east, west, and south are, and then you're as good as home. Note, when I shared my lesson plan with Grover, he pointed out that this method of navigation only works if you know in which direction your home lies. Also, it has proven to be less effective during daylight hours. Oh well, it's a start.
The Pegasus Stables, brought to you by Pete the Pelicus. Winged horses need a place to call home too. And Camp Half-Blood is delighted that some have made theirs here. Cleaning the stables might not be much fun, but the flights more than make up for it. So if you fancy a horse-powered swoop through the sky, stop by and meet the herd, and be sure to bring donuts. The Myrmeki's Lair, brought to you by Pete the Pelicus. This site should come with a warning sign. Keep out! If ever you find yourself near the monstrous anthill, be sure to ditch any shiny metal you might have on your person. The giant ants find it irresistible. What they don't like are certain waterways. The Zephyrs Creek runs between the main campgrounds and the ants' lair, which is probably why they haven't invaded, though the queen ant might just do a flyby sometime. If they ever decide to cross Long Island Sound, however, New York City could be in for a world of hurt. The Geysers, brought to you by Pete the Palicus. Come to a land apart, a land of misty magic and moist tropical breezes, where delightful humidity thickens the air and kisses your skin until it glows. You'll know you're near when sweat trickles down your back, dampens your hair, and weighs down your clothes. Once here, give voice to your offering to the geyser gods, a poem, a song, or a joke told with spot-on comedic timing. Then thrill to the whoosh of water from the amazing twin gushing geysers. Bow in the presence of the powerful Palicoi. And be sure to fill out the customer satisfaction survey before you leave. Water, Water Everywhere by Pete the Palicus. Being a god of a local underground water supply, I'm naturally tapped into the goings-on at Camp Half-Blood. Exploding toilets? Heard about that one. Son of Poseidon claimed in a stream during Capture the Flag? Got the details courtesy of Zephyrus Creek. Underwater kiss? Canoe Lake gushed about it for days afterward. Stories like that trickle into Polly and me all the time. We've heard stuff that made us flush. I tell you more, but I don't want to flood you with information that might bog you down. But pay us a visit sometime if you want. We'd come to you, but Chiron has banned us from the showers. The Strawberry Fields, brought to you by Pete the Palicus. Is there a tastier treat on a hot summer day than a plump, juicy, sunned, warm strawberry? Mouth-wateringly delicious. You can't eat just one. Luckily, here at Camp Half-Blood, strawberries are always on the menu and on the outbound delivery truck. Pick Your Own by Miranda Gardiner. Unless you're a child of Demeter or Dionysus, you'll probably overlook the strawberry fields while you're at Camp Half-Blood. I get that. Unlike the combat arena, the climbing wall, Half-Blood Hill, and other common areas, the fields are ordinary. Well, except for the whole growing perfect berries year-round thing. It's too bad if you overlook the place, though, because the strawberries play a vital role at camp. They make us money, which pays for a lot of useful stuff here at Camp Half-Blood. Think that complimentary orange t-shirt you're wearing just magically appeared out of nowhere? Not quite. You might be interested in knowing how the decision to grow strawberries came about. Then again, you might not. Feel free to move on to the next chapter if you're not. Just know you'll be missing out on some truly delicious camp info. Still with me? Okay, here's how it went down. Back in ancient times, Camp Half-Blood was self-sustaining, a bastion of locally grown produce and free-range meat and poultry products. When the camp moved to Long Island, though, the crops and herds didn't come with it. For a long while, campers had to make do by hunting, fishing, and gathering, old-world caveman style. What we couldn't hunt and gather, we traded for with local farmers, which was okay when Long Island was sparsely populated. Then New York City ballooned into a megalopolis, and urban sprawl oozed onto the island,
with communities erupting nearby almost overnight. After the third mortal sighting of teenage demigods running through neighborhoods with bows and arrows, Chiron decided it was time to make some changes. He convened the head counselors of the 9 inhabited cabins to discuss the issue. The Hephaestus kids were on a quest for celestial bronze, and Zeus's cabin was empty because he'd curtailed his extracurricular activities to appease Hera. The hunters were on a stopover, though, so cabin 8 was occupied.
"We need a way to supply the camp," Chiron said. "Any ideas?"
"Yes, we take what we need by force," bellowed the leader of the Ares cabin.
"Or we could just, you know, steal it," suggested the Hermes representative.
"No, no."
The son of Apollo whipped out his lyre.
"We should sing for our supper, as did the minstrels of yore."
"Of your what?" asked the Dionysus counselor.
"What?"
"The minstrels of your..."
the Dionysus girl said impatiently.
"Of your what?"
A representative of the visiting hunters intervened.
"Not your, your."
The Dionysus girl gave up.
"This is getting us nowhere," the daughter of Athena stood. "Chiron, the camp needs a steady source of income."
"Agreed,"
Chiron said.
"Suggestions?"
"One."
She rested her fingertips on the table and surveyed the others with great solemnity.
"We will sell something that people will buy in massive quantities."
"Wine," called the Dionysus girl.
"Weapons,"
yelled the Ares boy.
"Vocal arrangements in four-part harmony,"
sang out the Apollo counselor.
"Food."
All eyes turned to the Demeter boy who had spoken. He shrugged. "People always need food. Big city like New York, lots of people, lots of customers." Chiron stroked his beard.
"I like it, but what kind of food?"
That wasn't an easy question to answer. The Athena and Dionysus cabins wanted to sell food associated with their godly parents, olives and olive oil in honor of Athena, and grapes, grape juice, grape jelly, and wine, again, for Dionysus. The Hermes, Artemis, and Ares kids suggested putting their herding, hunting, and slicing and dicing talents to use and opening a butcher shop. Poseidon's daughter campaigned loudly for a seafood shack that offered both Manhattan and New England clam chowder. Apollo's son, still stuck on his original idea, tried to woo the Aphrodite counselor to his cause by pointing out that music was the food of love. She wasn't buying it, and neither, she said disdainfully, would any self-respecting customer. The discussion was escalating into an argument when the Demeter head counselor offered one last suggestion.
"What about this?"
He held out a small red object.
"Miniature explosive," the Ares boy bellowed. "Duck!"
"It's not an explosive or a duck," the Demeter boy said.
"It's a berry native to this land. Grows all over the place here."
The Aphrodite girl wrinkled her nose.
"Excuse me, but ew, there are seeds all over the outside. So unattractive. And red? That color is so overdone, fruit-wise."
"Yes, but it's tasty," the Demeter counselor said.
"I call it a strawberry."
"Why?" the Athena girl wanted to know.
"Because blueberry, raspberry, blackberry, and cranberry were taken. Here, try one."
He spilled a handful onto the table. The other counselors and Chiron sampled the strawberries.
"Sweet," drawled the Dionysus counselor.
Even the Aphrodite girl agreed, though she picked off the seeds first. Chiron asked the Demeter boy to stand.
It seems we have our product,
he said.
Will you and your siblings oversee the crop and grow it in abundance?
The Demeter boy straightened his shoulders and lifted his chin. We will make it our sacred duty, he said. Though we might ask the satyrs for backup on the reed pipe and the Dionysus kids for an assist now and then.
The Dionysus counselor gave him a thumbs up. The Apollo boy strummed his lyre for attention.
Gentle souls, hear my pledge. I will make it my sacred duty to name and market our newfound venture.
He strummed another chord, adjusted the tuning, and strummed again. I will even